You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Monday on the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 855-752-4842. That's 855-752-4842. And as promised, I'm joined by Dr. Anthony Eastreet. And, you know, Dr. Eastreet, if I tried to talk about all the accolades and all the accomplishments that you have in your lifetime, we wouldn't have time to have this conversation. So, first off, you represent social workers. Let's talk a little bit about what a social worker is.
Thank you so much for having me on your show, Earl. Yes, I am the CEO of the National Association of Social Workers, and we are the largest professional membership organization for social workers in the U.S., and predominantly in the world. And so when we talk about social work, we talk about individuals that are trained and degreed through a Council of Social Work Education accredited program. So they have the skills, knowledge, and ability to work with individuals, families, and communities, but also organizations and policy, right? And so we cover that whole spectrum from, you know, birth all the way to death, and individuals come to see us. They are going to experience assessments. They're going to experience interventions, treatment plannings. Some of that also includes policy work and understand how policies impact individuals and families, but also making sure that we take the voices of individuals and families to make sure that we're advocating for sensible policies that not only benefit or take into account those that are most vulnerable, but also social workers that work with these individuals. And so, you know, again, a social worker covers a wide range of services. We are the largest provider of behavioral services in the U.S., but we also have our humble beginnings working in the child welfare system, where we still are doing a lot of great work. But we're also in technology, banking, finance. We're helping artificial intelligence feel and become more humanized. And so social workers are everywhere.
Are you facing a shortage of social workers? Are we facing a shortage of social workers?
So that's an interesting question, right? According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, we are one of the fastest growing professions out there, but that is only half of that story. I think the other half of that story is that we're seeing social workers leaving the profession because of burnout, because of low wages, because of lack of support from, you know, our state and federal governments to make sure that we can do the work that we do and still be sustainable in the lifestyle that we want. And so what I mean by that is, you know, how do we work with social workers to reduce the caseload? How do we work with social workers to improve working conditions so that when they go on vacation, they can actually relax and go on vacation? And so, you know, while we are a fast-growing profession, I don't want us to lose sight on the fact that many social workers are leaving the field or transitioning to different areas where the salary is comparable to the work that we're doing, but also there's a decrease in burnout in those areas, right? And so it's a double-sided question where, yes, we are growing, but also people are leaving because of the lack of support that we're receiving from funding, whether it's through insurance or through sensible policies that help to impact the individuals, families, and communities that we serve.
If you're just joining us, I'm joined by Dr. Anthony Eastreet. He is the CEO, basically, of social workers. And so let me ask you. I spent a lot of time in the public school system in watching some social workers dealing with what Dr. Eastreet is just some deplorable situations that did not exist for social workers when I was a young man. As I told you, I'm 70 years old, and some of the things that are happening today, homelessness amongst families, mothers moving their children weekly, sometimes daily, possessions in black garbage bags from place to place, children hungry, families hungry, not having any clothing. I mean, these are things, behavioral issues, lead poisoning of children because of the places where they live and stay. Children who live in places like the state of Wisconsin where I live and who don't have coats and don't have gloves. And, you know, it's a horrific reality for the wealthiest nation on earth, sir. It's a lot more difficult to be a social worker today than it was 40 years ago. Is it safe to say that?
I think the profession of social work has certainly evolved, right? And I think that everything that you're saying is where social workers are, right? You know, we help individuals, families, and communities find the resources that they need so that they can live the best version of the life that they want to live, right? And so we address unhoused. We address people that are unhoused. We address mental health, substance use. We address child welfare issues. And again, you know, I really want to say that social workers are, in fact, the heartbeat of our communities. You know, every day we encounter people in different various stages of life, whether it is, you know, at their lowest point or they may be in acute crisis or they're trying to prevent a crisis. They're going to come across a social worker that is able to help them, right? And I think the one thing that is always important is, you know, social workers are always on the front line. We are literally helping to maintain that social safety net that we see and that we've benefited from for many decades. The challenge becomes that, you know, while we care, not we, while society in itself cares and they understand the issues, you know, that compassion alone is not enough. We need to make sure that people are engaging in that compassion plus action, right? That care that you see for that person that is unhoused, that care that you see for somebody that is impacted by mental health or substance use, how are you turning that into action? How are you helping to help society become better, right? And so social workers, we are experts in building community. We are experts in helping people to find their core group of people, right? But we're also experts in helping people to reduce the impact of mental health and behavioral health, helping people to find resources when they are dealing with being unhoused or housing instability. We are also involved in people when they come in contact with us on their worst days, when there may be some child welfare or child abuse issues. We're there as well, trying to make sure that those families get the resources that they need so they can be reunified or so that they can continue to engage in seeking the help that will get them to the next phase of their life.
You know, Dr. Eastreet, we don't see social workers. So therefore, since they're unseen, you know, it's hard for people to really comprehend and understand the work that they do. Is it safe to say that?
Yeah, so I think, you know, to what you're saying, I think people see social workers, but I also think that social work has been impacted by a bad brand, right? And so when we see the portrayal of social workers, it's typically in the child welfare system. It's typically we are portrayed as being overworked, ran down, and highly stressed, right? While some of that is true, I think the other part of it, too, is that social workers are everywhere. We are in certainly child welfare, but we're also in mental health, behavioral health, banking, entertainment, and technology. In fact, I was at an event this weekend where social workers are working with the entertainment industries, where they're working with actors behind the scenes to ensure that while they're putting on the great movies that they're doing for all of us to watch and enjoy, that they're also maintaining their mental health and wellness behind the scenes to be able to continue that kind of work. And so while, yes, we're, in some ways we're unseen, I think it's because people have they have a vision of what a social worker looks like, and we've certainly outgrown that vision. And so when I say social workers are everywhere, more people than not are probably coming into contact with a social worker, and they just don't realize it. And so some of that is understanding that the social work brand has changed in terms of we are everywhere. But the other part of it, too, is if you've not experienced a social worker in your lifetime, I can almost guarantee 9 out of 10 times that you will come across a social worker at some point in time in your life.
So you chose social work as a vocation. Why?
That's a great question, and I get asked that a lot, right? But the reality is that I've always had a connection to behavioral health and ensuring that people can show up as their best selves, right? The other part of it, too, is it really does matter, like, who you come in contact with. My mentor was a Black male social worker. And when I was an undergrad at Bowie State University, an HBCU, my undergrad degree was in psychology. But then I came across my mentor, Mike Green, who told me about social work, who guided me through social work, who helped me understand social work. And as a result of that, I became a social worker. And now I make it a point to, you know, when I go out and talk to people, I help them to understand the scope of social work. But I also offer to mentor them in this space, because the reality of the situation is social work is one of the best professions that I could have ever chosen. I am a proud social worker. I love the work that I do. At the same time, understanding that we have a need for more social workers to be able to do this work. It is sometimes considered selfless work, but at the same time, it is very rewarding work. I just wish that at the same time, when we as we are thinking of it as rewarding work, that we're also compensated at a higher rate, that insurance companies are not constantly creating more and more barriers so that social workers leave the managed care space.
You know, when you look at where we are today with the administration that's in office now, and clearly safety net programs are being eliminated, cut back, the impact that that's going to have on families that need social workers and social workers who are scouring, you know, the heavens to find support for families at a time when those things are being cut back, the impact that must have on a social worker must be tremendous.
Yes, and so
how do they separate that and keep that? You know, there when you're watching this, it's hard for me to imagine that you know they can hang on. Can you hang on a second, Dr. Eastreet?
Yes.
All right, 855-752.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Us at 855-752-4842. My guest is Dr. Anthony Eastreet. He is the CEO of social workers in this country. Dr. Eastreet, we've got a caller. Let's bring her on, Liz from Sarkville. Good morning to you. You have a question or comment for the doctor, Liz?
I just thank you, Earl. I love your show. And thank you, Dr. Eastreet, for all that you do. It's what you do runs the spectrum of all ages, because I have to speak with social workers because my mom has had two strokes and she has to go to the hospital, So I speak with social workers a lot, and they are so kind. They arrange my mom's transportation and they give me updates. They arrange transportation back to her assisted living center where she lives. And so I appreciate you and all that you do immensely.
Hey, Liz, thank you very much for the call. Dr. Eastreet?
Liz, thank you so much. First of all, you know, I do hope that your mom is doing well and that she continues to do well. I am so glad to hear that your experience with social workers have been positive. I think to your point, you know, it really does talk about, you know, where social workers are. You know, we are also in, you know, healthcare settings and assisted living facilities. And I'm glad that, you know, we're able to help you and your mom to access the resources that you need so that she can be the best version of herself going forward.
You know, Dr. Eastreet, there was a time, again, when I was a young man, social workers were women. Has that changed much?
You know, it's interesting. You know, social work has traditionally been characterized as a profession that, you know, is predominantly people that go into it are women. I think the reality of the situation is we're seeing more and more men go into the profession, and in fact, there's quite a bit of men that are in the social work profession. I think that there is a unique diversity that within our entire profession that looks at men, women, trans women, black, white, Asian, you name it. We cover the spectrum on diversity, and I think that is one of the beauties of our profession is that.
Dr. Eastreet. Hey. Diversity, equity, and inclusion. How were you able to continue to support diversity, equity, and inclusion when that's become just a no-no in this administration?
Because the reality of the situation is, Earl, and I say this with my entire being, people have mischaracterized diversity, equity, and inclusion in such a way that they only look at it in terms of race. When I talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion, it is the full spectrum of how people show up in this world, whether it is race, ethnicity, gender orientation, gender,
disability,
like all the different things. And so when people say, oh, let's get rid of DE&I, I'm not really sure what they're talking about, because the diversity, equity, and inclusion makes sure that people can access buildings. When you have to utilize a ramp because you're in a wheelchair and utilize a button to get into a building to open a door, like that is diversity, equity, and inclusion. It's literally the definition of making sure that people feel included and like they belong in the community and the society that we have built today. That's it.
So you refuse to allow the pressure of this administration to force, you know, what you guys and what you do and believe in to change that mission.
You know, I think diversity, equity, and inclusion have always been in the core fabric of social work as a profession. As we advocated for social justice, you know, social workers have been on the front lines of every major civil rights movement, social justice movement. And so when you think about diversity, equity, and inclusion as a new topic that people have been talking about post George Floyd, it has been in the fabric of social work the entire time. And so for us, diversity, equity, and inclusion is really answering the question is, how do we help people feel like they can have access, that they are included, and that they belong, right? And those are three fundamental questions to really that help guide our work, right? If you show up in a social worker's office, they're really going to make sure, like, how can you live the best version of yourself? And that's whether you are a trans person, a black person, a white person, or you identify as something else. We're going to make sure that you can feel included, that you have access to things, but also that you do feel like you belong, right? And that includes fighting for policies that help to increase that. And so when we look at, you know, when we look at state policies, we're always going to advocate on behalf of increasing diversity, equity, and inclusion in all sectors of life.
You know, Dr. Eastreet, it has been an honor and a privilege and a pleasure to have this dialogue with you this morning, and really the strawberry on, you know, the ice cream is where you just laid it out on diversity, equity, and inclusion, man. That, you know, that is a must, I think, when you're talking about social work. It's a must when you're talking about life, right? And I don't care where it is.
Yeah.
That's who we are, right? As Americans, that's who we are as people. We aren't one people, you know, one group of people. I mean, we're one group of people. That's who we are.
No, absolutely. And I think to your point, the more, you know, as people are talking about how divided we are, it's diversity, equity, inclusion that brings us together. The ability to have different thoughts, the ability to be able to talk about that, right? And it spreads across a lot of different topics. I think what has happened is we've allowed too many people to relegate diversity, equity, inclusion into just race.
So, Dr. Eastreet, we have to leave it at that. We'll reach back out to you. Thank you very much for your time, sir.
All right, thank you so much.
All right. You're listening to a Motown Monday on the Earl Ingram Show. Motown Monday on the Earl Ingram Show. I wish you could hear, you know, this song kick into the next phase. Let's play for a couple seconds. Slipping into darkness. Welcome back to a Motown Monday on the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 855-967-2789. Cardi, I don't think you ever heard that, right?
Nah.
Man, you need to hear it all the way through. It's bad. But anyway, you know, we've been talking about Elon Musk and Donald Trump and all of those MAGAs who support Elon Musk cutting the government. And, you know, we're always talking about the waste in the government and, you know, people who are getting contracts who don't deserve them. And I forgot who had called earlier, and he mentioned something about Elon Musk getting contracts. Well, Elon Musk's double standard. SpaceX wins government contract while public services face deep cuts. A $38.85 million contract awarded to Elon Musk's SpaceX sparks outrage as his government office slashes funding for healthcare. Now, we know Elon Musk just had, you know, one of his rockets, you know, explode again. And yet he's got a government contract. And yet he's cutting all of these other educational and social programs. I don't know why people don't see a problem with that, right? He's benefiting from government programs while he's cutting all of these other programs. But anyway, just thought I'd throw that out there. But here's something that really upsets me to no end. And we supposedly have freedom of speech in this nation, and it's being eroded right before our eyes. And this double standard of what speech is accepted and what speech is not accepted, the fact that we as Americans see this happening and we aren't outraged enough to call, you know, this administration out on it. Immigration agents arrest Palestinian activists who helped lead Columbia University protests. Now, when the height of the war in Gaza with Israel and, you know, I don't know, I'm having trouble thinking, Hamas was taking place. And there were college students all over this nation voicing their displeasure with the universities who supported Israel during that war that is still going on for the most part, except for this short hiatus. And yet these students were called all sorts of horrible names and traitors and how dare they. And again, it helps to have been around for a while. Because I remember many college students during the Vietnam War. If you've been around a while, you remember on almost every college campus. That's what kind of helped bring the war to an end. The outrage of young people in the street and on universities, in universities, constantly saying, no, this is not right. University students are free. They've always been free to say what they feel. Throughout my entire life, that's the way it's been. And because they are free, they have been able to bring changes that many of us, you know, who have lived some time and, you know, kind of protective of our jobs and other things, that we can't speak out freely. And so the way this has been structured in this country for eons was that students were free, and they were free to speak their minds, and there would not be repercussions. Well, so why has that changed? I mean, all the different things that have changed and continue to change in this nation, I don't know it anymore. You know, and especially, you know, over the last 7-8 weeks. But I'll tell you, I was even opposed to it when Joe Biden was the president. I remember going down to UWM, University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, and they had the tent cities there. And there was all this conversation about those students who were ill-informed. And they have no right to be supporting the Palestinians. And so they should totally support Israel. And I'm like, hey, man, that doesn't make sense to me. To condemn students for their beliefs when that wasn't the way it was when we were young. It might have been. Some people may have spoken out about it, but not to the degree that is happening right now to condemn students for their constitutional rights. I mean, I thought that's what people fought, bled, and died for in this country. Now, that's what I was taught. People, you know, have a right to their views. Well, guess what? So why are immigration agents arresting Palestinian activists, you know, who led protests, peaceful protests, on these various campuses? So I invited some of the young protesters from UWM to my show. And people said to me, man, you had better watch it, man. You shouldn't, you're taking a chance. I'm like, hey, man, if it's considered taking a chance to expect your nation to live up to its creed, and people are afraid and they call that taking a chance, no, maybe there need to be more Earl Ingrams. I'm sorry. We have to be willing to challenge our nation to be right, to do what's right. This is not acceptable to say to people and young people who are doing all that they can to build a future for themselves and trying to hold our nation accountable for what it says it is. Federal immigration authorities arrested a Palestinian activist Saturday who played a prominent role in Columbia University's protests against Israel, a significant escalation in the Trump administration's pledge to detain and deport student activists. What? Detain and deport student activists? Hey, man, that's what happens on university campuses. And so now we're going to do away with that? Let's go to Bill from Oconomowoc. Good morning to you, Bill. How you doing, sir?
I really like the topic you're talking on. We all remember Tiananmen Square.
Oh, absolutely.
And isn't that what's going on right here in the U.S.?
Well, you know, Bill, not all of us remember Tiananmen Square, but for those of us who do, university students who were outraged in the behavior of their country and tanks running over, you know, students unarmed and before the whole world. And we condemned that, Bill. You remember how we condemned that? How was this so different?
It's not different at all. The bottom line is we're going through COVID in a different way. Not COVID the virus, COVID the handling of how he handled COVID. Remember, it's going to be over by spring. Now, it's not going to be over by spring. Millions died when spring came, or a million died. We have to show the world and our country we're built on democracy, not communism.
So let me ask you, you say we have to show, you know, we were supposedly that before Donald Trump. So if we were that before Donald Trump, then how does this one man come and dismantle that? Can you tell me?
Well, here's what that one man is going to accomplish. You watch the backlash. You watch an asking for all the funding of Israel. You watch how people are going to, this man has started a movement. Now, you saw what happened, I don't know if it was this weekend or last weekend in Washington, with the support of Ukraine, right out in Washington.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm talking about. Look at the backlash. Our great congressmen can't have town halls, and our senators can't have town halls, and our elected far-right officials can't have town halls. Now, there's plenty of Republicans left that can have town halls, and they won't get shouted out because they see the need to uphold the oath of office. The others, they don't care about the oath of office. They could care less. They just care on making people, the right guy, smile. Well, I'm sick and tired of it. We're all sick and tired of it. We are a nation of people living under a constitution and justice. Suddenly, justice and the constitution is not important.
Hey, Bill, let me ask you this. So, you know, 48% of Americans didn't vote, or whatever the number was. Do you think that, and we've got to figure out a way to organize those people and hear their voices? Because if you get 10% of those 48% of the people who didn't vote, now you can bring some real pressure on the MAGAs and the Republicans, even if you got 5% of them. Hey, Bill, thank you very much for the call. 855-752-4842. You're tuned into a Motown Monday on the Earl Ingram Show.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Motown Monday on the Earl Ingram Show. Yes. Shortly, we'll be taking it to the streets. We'll be gathering at Memorial Square on 6th and Main here in Racine. An organized group, you don't know me, but I'm your brother. And they're going to be organized. And they are going to be, and they are there, and this is the second week in a row, and they're going to continue to do this. They have had enough. That's what it's going to take all across this nation. Groups of citizens and people who have had enough. Enough talk. Enough feeling victimized. Because, as Tom from LA always says, we the people are the government. And it is going to take that all over this nation, in townships, in cities, all over this nation. I don't care if it takes, you know, during the civil rights struggle in Birmingham, Alabama, 320 days, blacks refused to get on the buses because of injustice. They weren't allowed to sit wherever they wanted to sit. And so nobody would help them. Nobody would could feel their pain or understand their cause. And Dr. King, one of the greatest efforts ever witnessed. That's 368 days or somewhere around there. It was a year, over a year. Blacks walked, refused to get on the buses. And guess what? That policy was changed. It wasn't changed because of government. Government didn't change it. The politricksters didn't change it. It was the people. It was the people who had had enough. And they organized. And it began. 1 second, then to minutes, then to hours, then to days, then to weeks, then to months, and over a year. And said, we're not going to take it anymore. We're not going to tolerate it. Well, that's what's taking place this afternoon here in Racine, Wisconsin. Once again, 12 o'clock, Memorial Square, 6th and Main. As people have had enough, they're not asking anymore. Not asking all the people. Not asking the county supervisors. They're not asking the mayor. They're not asking the governor. They're not asking the president, the Congress people. They're not asking the president of the United States. They know that this is a battle that has to be won by the average rank and file American. So I'm thrilled that they feel that I have something to say. I do. And I'm going to say it. And I'm going to make it clear how proud I am of those citizens of the city of Racine. And that maybe they can be the impetus to move this thing forward. Hey, Eric from Tulsa, what's happening, man?
Hey, Earl. Happy Motown Monday, as always. I just got one question. I know you're running low on time, so I just got one question to ask all your listeners and to pose to everybody is, if you think about it, and, you know, because a lot of people complain about the Democrats, what they're not doing, they're hiding, et cetera, et cetera. And I've seen Representative Glenn Moore out there quite a bit. She was at the VA rally, and she's out there talking and warning people. But at what point in our history have politicians ever led a human rights movement?
Hey, Eric, I wish I had more time, man. Thank you very much for the call.
Thank you very much,
everybody who made the show go. Up next, Jane Madnair, Greg Bach Madnair on air. I'll let you know how great it was on tomorrow. You've been tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. Taking it to the street.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.